Ways and Means General Government Committee to order. First item on our agenda is Senate Bill 5503, and I'd like to call Representative Manish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Manish from Salem, and I appreciate the opportunity for me to depart temporarily from the Public Safety Subcommittee to come over and join you to speak briefly on behalf of the Capital Planning Commission. The Capital Planning Commission was established in 1948 as, in effect, a joint venture designed to bring together officials from the city and officials from state government to make sure that the interaction between the city and the state and also the adjoining county, and Marion County in particular, but also generally Polk County, was positive, to make sure that the officials were in touch with one another about state development of projects. In fact, I've often pointed to the Capital Planning Commission as one of the best examples of state and local cooperation. The state obviously has a tremendous impact in terms of its buildings and operations on this community, and much of that impact has been balanced because of the existence of the Capital Planning Commission. What the commission does basically is it reviews development plans for the state, and those development plans have to go through an approval process, which includes the Capital Planning Commission. State agency heads are on the Capital Planning Commission, but also a member of the House serves at the pleasure, basically, of the Speaker, and a member of the Senate serves at the pleasure of the Senate President. I was first appointed to the Capital Planning Commission during my first term by Speaker Vera Katz. That appointment was then renewed by the succeeding Republican Speaker, so that I served for 8 years as the House representative on the Capital Planning Commission. When I first came in, Cub Hawk had just stepped down. There was a little overlap in our time, but more recently, Senator Gerstler has been serving as the Senate representative on the Capital Planning Commission. Although it's not required by law, there's been a tendency for local representatives and senators to be put on the commission. But our job really is to watch out for the perspective of the legislature in terms of the state's development plans and any impact it may have on our capital and on our offices. But we also try to participate from a global perspective. What I'd like to emphasize about the Capital Planning Commission is it's one of the early examples of successful community planning in the United States. Planning of this kind became something of an in thing in the late 50s and into the 60s, but Oregon was in the forefront of the development of this commission. And even when we went through the phase of downsizing government and eliminating many boards and commissions, the Capital Planning Commission survived that process because of its capability to help the state implement its development programs, but also help the community be protected and to participate in that development process. What has amazed me about the Capital Planning Commission is it has managed to carry on with a very limited amount of staffing. You have one executive director who is not quite full-time. You have one secretary who is not quite full-time. And the other members are serving basically either public members, and you'll hear from the chair of the commission today, Carl Myers, who is also a public member, or as agency representatives or legislative representatives. We get more bang for the buck out of this Capital Planning Commission than just about any vital state organization that's around. And I wanted to leave you with that positive message. I've been very impressed about the bipartisan and bicameral support that we've had for the Capital Planning Commission, even in tough economic times, and in these better economic times, I would hope that we would continue to strongly support the operation of the commission. I thank you for inviting me in to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Manish. Is there any questions? What are some of the projects you're working on now?
Well, at any given time, any time an agency is adding to a structure or significantly changing a structure, the Capital Planning Commission will review it. I have been off the Capital Planning Commission. I did serve as the head of a task force, which I'll mention in a minute and answer your question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Crow. But Doug Kapp will be able to talk to you about the, what I'll call the smaller projects that are usually under review. But anytime there is a structural change for any of the buildings in the Capitol Mall, the Capital Planning Commission gets involved. It does not deal with interior design and those kinds of things. It's really the external impact on the community and the external look of state buildings. So I just got reappointed as a newly elected representative last week, so I've not had the opportunity to serve.
What are the dimensions of the mall? You think of it as down to the next major street, but then we have buildings beyond that. We have the archives building. Is that considered part of the mall?
It is. In fact, the archives building, Mr. Chairman, Senator Crow, the archives building is really on the last segment of the mall as you head north. The street that's just to the north of the archives building is considered the north end of the Capitol Mall. And I should mention quickly again, the Capitol Planning Commission does not just deal with the Capitol Mall, although the Capitol Mall seems to be the area where we have the most involvement because of concern about the exterior appearance of structures. And also, in answer, but if we talk about going west and east, you could go as far east as, for instance, there is the Safeway. If you think of visually, the Safeway store, that tends to run along the eastern boundary in that area. To the west, I believe the boundary runs along with the LNI building and that sort of region. It's the state-owned property. If I may, I'd also mention, you asked about projects. I was asked to serve as chair of a task force looking at the state penitentiary and the state hospital complexes, and we brought in community, county, neighborhood representatives as well as all the agency representatives, and we've developed recommendations for modifications to the master plan, which the Capitol Planning Commission also maintains for all the area. And we developed a consensus process about what the future will be. There's going to be some sports fields brought in, which Senator Courtney has encouraged, and that's all part of the package where there'll be open space, so you won't have encroachment of buildings near the penitentiary, but you'll see some positive use of the area for kids. I won't bore you with the half-hour speech about what this group came up with, but we also looked at the mental health needs, for instance, of the state hospital, make sure that they had adequate open space so that patients who are not dangerous, who are out and want to be able to enjoy the ground, have enough facilities for that. Buffer zones to allow the neighborhood to feel comfortable with having the state hospital in the neighborhood. A lot of positive things are done with the approval and the authorization of the Capitol Planning Commission to maintain that ambiance that you need in any thriving community. And I gave you a very long answer to a couple of short questions.
Jurisdiction over correctional institutions in Salem or over the human resource institutions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Crow, we do. And for instance, in that regard, when we've not looked at changes to, say, the state penitentiary or whatever, we've been able to remind corrections officials about the cap that is imposed on the size of those facilities and the number of inmates, and that's an important concern for Senator Courtney and myself, but Senator Courtney has been particularly careful about reminding them about their agreements about the number of inmates to be accommodated in those facilities, and even the footprint and the exterior appearance and how this interacts with services and facilities that are available in the community.
Any other questions? Comments? Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Mr. Cash, would you like to come forward?
Greetings. How are you?
Good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Cash presented, I think, most of his testimony yesterday. I'm sure if there's anything you'd like to add, he can do so at this time and respond to any questions that members of the committee might have.
Okay. Did you have any bad?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess maybe the only thing I would add, I think we left off yesterday just with just before any description of the budget itself or any going through any of the numbers, and I don't know if we necessarily have to do that. But Senator Crow, you asked about projects that we're anticipating dealing with. According to our statute, every state agency that has property within our jurisdiction is required, if they are requesting financial resources, capital resources, to submit prior or along with the submission of their budget, a description of those projects to the Capital Planning Commission. And prior to the budget, prior to the legislature convening, we, the commission, evaluates each of those projects to determine whether or not they are in compliance or have to be out of compliance with the adopted area plans. And it's also kind of an early warning system for us to be able to anticipate, should those projects go forward, what our workload is going to be for the next biennium. So in that regard, that's kind of a longer answer, but in that regard, the agencies have indicated an interest in and are seeking funding for the construction of a natural resources building on the Capitol Mall, and that would be up at the northern end. There is some discussion about a parking structure on the Capitol Mall.
Where would that be located?
That would be, I think it's anticipated to be on what's now considered the yellow lot. It's now currently a surface parking lot. There is a request for...
High-rise?
Yes. There's a request for funding to move the Capitol Mall houses into a configuration at the end of the mall so that there is, in fact, a boundary on D Street that would indicate to the neighborhood that the state will not proceed beyond that boundary. There's a significant amount of anxiety, I think, that as state government grows and large buildings continue to get built, that at some point the state is going to spill over that northern boundary of the Capitol Mall. And the placement of those houses at the end, along with some open green space, a task force report that was submitted to the commission and changed the Capitol Mall area plan. In fact, Representative Mannix was on that task force as well. And there's planning money being requested for the construction of a justice building on the Capitol Mall. And then in addition to that, the Forestry Department is interested in refurbishing and actually tearing down and rebuilding some of its old buildings on the Forestry Complex on State Street. And as we all know, because we read about it in the newspaper as well, the State Fair is interested in doing some renovation of their buildings. All of those projects will come to the Capitol Planning Commission.
Any other questions?
No questions, but comment. I think probably this would be a good agency to change their mission to also include prison solving.
Yeah, there might be an additional request for funding, so long as they're not cited in sale.
Well, their authority's a little broad.
Yeah. Ms. Ames, would you like to give your request?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with the Department of Administrative Services. Yesterday, I got this cool one-page handout that summarizes the budget. The governor's recommended budget for 9901 is $248,000, and that includes 1.63 full-time equivalent positions. That's a 10% increase over the 9799 budget. That's primarily a result of the roll-up of salary costs and increased cost of goods and services. That budget continues all services. It also continues to fund the commission through charges to other state agencies, and those charges are based on the number of positions in each agency. On the back of the handout shows the detail of the development of the budget. The 9799 legislatively adopted budget was $215,000 other funds and that same 1.63 full-time equivalent position. The e-board added about $8,500 for the increase in salary costs that was allocated to all agencies. And then the major current service level adjustments were the increased PERS rate, the salary roll-up costs, and then the increased cost of goods and services. There is one small policy package that the agency is requesting, maintenance and services. It's $3,750. This would be used to purchase equipment maintenance agreements, to be able to produce some maps for planning purposes, and to connect to EdNet, which is the agency's internet service. And that was all I had.
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood you. Did you say that there's a 10% increase in the FTE?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moserly, there was a 10% increase in the dollars. Since the 97.99, there's been no increase in FTE.
Any other questions at this particular time? I apologize for being absent involved with another bill. Senator Crow, let's take just a moment. We're without a quorum to go into work session, but he's been on the
Ways and Means before. Do you ever sponsor any bills that you go testify for?
I've got a leave to go testify at the end of this period. So yeah, I do.
Let's see. With Senator Lim, I write in, we're at the full quorum at this particular point. Are there any questions that need to be asked before we consider moving forward with the work session?
Some of us try and get our bill passed before this week.
thank you, Representative Hansen. Your point is well taken, and for those of us who wait until April 14th to file our tax return, you certainly wouldn't expect to be trying to get our bills in the hopper before the 1st of February, would you? Let's see. Before we go into work session, I would like to have a response from Georgine Bailey from Legislative Assistance.
On the spreadsheet, which is, I think I distributed it yesterday, but I also have it on the second page of the package on Senate Bill 550 through the Tax Returning Commission. The traditional spreadsheet that we generally produce, and it's basically the same thing that Ms. Ames has gone through. You'll see under 9901 budget development calculations, the administrative board, emergency board, and pays in $13,068 non-fixed personal services. That's the $100 mass transit tax. And the cost of goods and services is the inflation. State government service charges is the assessments and charges to the commission. To bring the current service level to $244,450. And the one package that Ms. Ames just described, the $3,750, gives you the total governor's recommended budget of $248,200.
Are there any questions before we... I have just one question that deals with the Capital Planning Commission in general. Recognizing that the fee, there's a fee charged to each agency per square foot, I think, presently to fund the Capital Planning Commission. And there are no general funds utilized directly by this budget. Are there any ongoing discussions which would discuss actual expansions or further enhancements to the actual mall itself? And tell me, if you would, the process. We talked just a little bit briefly yesterday about the liaison nature of your agency with the city of Salem, Marion County, as between those government agencies in the state.
Mr. Chair, if you're asking, is there any plan to expand the Capitol Mall footprint itself? No, none that I'm aware of. I think the major challenge by state agencies, and because the Capitol Mall plan identifies criteria by which agencies are judged to be eligible to locate facilities on the Capitol Mall. And as you will notice just by physical observation, there are empty sections of the Capitol Mall. So the real issue relating to the Capitol Mall is what I guess is called, I've heard it with other agencies, the build-out of the mall, how to fill the mall up. And there have been some studies, some facility studies that have been done by the Facilities Division, not very recently, but at least in the past, that have tried to anticipate what the growth of state government might be, and therefore what those facility needs are going to be, and then are those facility needs eligible for location on the Capitol Mall. The Capitol Mall is intended to be reserved for the central offices of state government, not computer centers or what I guess they're called sort of back office functions. And so even as Representative Mannix was speaking earlier about the evaluation of the state penitentiary and state hospital grounds. There's a significant amount of available land there, and one of the issues that came up in that task force effort was, well, if the mall, quote, gets built out, then what is the plan for where state agencies, should they continue to grow or need additional space, where would they then be located? That's a fairly long-range view, certainly not within the next 10 or 15 years, probably. But at least it tells you that there are some people that are thinking about, you know, what are the long-term facility needs of state government.
And the steps Mr. Cass that are taken in that, in the discussion of that build-out process, that someone conceives an idea that we need a new building on the Capitol Mall, and do they come to you? You generate the idea. Somebody wakes up from a bad dream and gives you a call in the middle of the night and say, "I just envisioned a beautiful new building at the far end," or something of that nature.
Mr. Chair, the process, the very first step that is taken when an agency is interested in locating a new building anywhere is to come to the Capital Planning Commission and present their concept. And the first decision that's made is a siting decision, where to locate that building. Now, if, for example, they've predetermined that the Capital Mall would be an appropriate location, then the very first action that we would take, formal action in a formally adopted decision and order, would be, is this an appropriate location for that building? And that would be judged by the criteria that's already been established in the Capitol Mall area plan, or any other plan for that matter, wherever else it might be located. Then, if location decision has been approved, then the agency goes back and begins to work on their design drawings and their engineering and architectural work and so forth, and then they bring that back through the process as well. So the adoption of a building goes through several steps before it is finally approved.
Thank you. Now, I'm sorry to be such a neophyte in that regard. For instance, the printing or the mail center for the Department of Administrative Services, they don't come to the Capitol Planning Commission to put it out in an industrial park.
Yes, they do. If you're saying if they were to locate for the first time, they would come to the Capitol Planning Commission, and they would say, particularly if they're interested in locating within an area where we have an adopted area plan, and we have 9 area plans that we administer, and they're generally around major state facilities that already exist, the state penitentiary, state hospital, the school for the deaf, school for the blind, state fair, and so forth. And in that case, that is in what's called the Airport Road area plan that includes forestry, the ODOT maintenance facility, the lottery, the print shop, and the motor pool, and the military department. It's all contained within an area plan. So if they were, for example, to say, and if this is your question, we would like to build a new facility there and they weren't already there, well, then we would go through the same criteria that we would if someone were to say we want to locate on the Capitol Mall. There's criteria already established in these area plans, like a comprehensive plan that says this is either appropriate or not appropriate, or it could be appropriate if these modifications were made to your plan.
Okay, so, and amongst the 9 adopted area plans, then would be the Capitol Mall. That would be one of the 9 adopted area plans. So, in conclusion, in this line of questioning, in the 9 different area plans, are there any ongoing major discussions relative to expansions and build-outs of significant facilities?
Mr. Chair, that's really a good question, because it's and maybe I'm editorializing here a little bit, but I think that state government has only just recently sort of come out of the trough, if we might put it that way, from the impact of Measure 5. And I think state agencies over the last several years have been reticent to be thinking very much about capital expansion. We discovered a couple of years ago that a number of state agencies that actually had facility needs were finding themselves not recommending new capital construction, but we're leasing facilities. And that created some, we thought, some inefficiencies in the way that state funding was being used. But it was a response to an unwillingness, I think, to go forward with major capital plans, which are typically, have larger dollar price tags attached to them. But I think as we've been coming out of that phase, more and more state agencies are thinking more seriously about what their facility needs are. And in the last biennium, there was an initiative to seek legislative approval to a longer-range planning cycle, not for Capital Planning Commission purposes, but for agency purposes, to try to get out of the two-year cycle that they were in, to develop their budgets, their capital needs for legislative consideration on a two-year-by-two-year basis, and to think more in terms of 4 to 6 year time horizon, and to be able to get some kind of legislative buy-off, not necessarily approval, because it doesn't work that way, but a buy-off for the longer-term plan. And we would like to do that. The Capital Planning Commission itself does not do facilities planning for individual agencies. We function more like a planning commission would as a reviewer of an agency's plans, but we would like to encourage state agencies to be thinking longer range about their facilities needs so that we could answer that question better.
But you do, in fact, then see that in that process, for instance, an existing state agency that's presently leasing facilities because of this unwillingness to respond to the desire to go out and build a flashy building as we come through, as you speak, a trough. And they bring to you a plan. I get the sense that perhaps the plan has been much longer term as we've been going through this trough. And now it's if I could use an oscilloscope, the oscillations are moving down, and so we're coming back in our way of thinking to a shortened period of time from beginning to completion, so that a two-year time, or maybe a little bit longer than that, perhaps, to get the plan conceived and the financing arranged and buy-in on it. And then the building, we're actually moving on the oscilloscope to faster and faster conception to construction and completion. Is that
Mr. Chair, I believe that's right. And I mentioned earlier that when our early warning system, if either in the association that I have with the facilities, people within each of the agencies, just by word of mouth or we serve in various capacities where we find out what those longer-range planning cycles are. But as I also mentioned, our more definite early warning system is when agencies are actually asking for planning dollars from the legislature in order to do something. And in this case, the Justice Department, for example, has requested, I think, $200,000 to do a planning in the next biennium for the building of a building on the Capitol Mall. So that building would not be, if those planning funds are approved, that building would not be built, of course, because they don't have the financial resources to do that. But they do have enough to do the site work, evaluating exactly what their space needs are going to be, and that sort of thing.
And another agency of appropriation and ways and means will hear an issue as to whether or not they need $200,000 to go ahead with the feasibility and the study, and then that study would be authorized by yourselves through the Capital Planning Commission. And is that what the location and siting and so forth?
Mr. Chair, yes, not entirely. We wouldn't authorize the spending of those monies, but they would return to us as those monies are expended when they've determined through their own feasibility studies that they've decided to move forward on a project.
I see. Representative Messerly,
thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the Department of Forestry going through a restructuring of similar facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, yes, they are, and they are now in the second phase of that restructuring. They received some financial resources from the legislature in this last biennium, the current biennium, and have proceeded with some of the reconstruction of those buildings and are seeking funding to finish their project in the next biennium.
As they get through different phases, will they be continually contacting the department, or have they got the authority to go ahead from your commission to do all of their phases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Netherly, that's a good question about our process. They came, and they actually were very good about this. They came to the Capital Planning Commission early on to just simply identify a kind of their conceptual approach and ask for the commission's general approval. It wasn't a specific approval, building by building, but general approval, and to give them any response back that the commission might have that would help guide their further development of their own plans. Then what they're doing is coming back with their individual plans on each building. From our perspective, that's a good approach for them to use because they're continually keeping the commission informed as to what their plans are. And as it turned out, I mean, it just so happens with forestry that they received their financial resources to do this actually a couple of biennium ago, and their plans have changed somewhat. So they continue to keep us informed, and we have them on our agenda from time to time to update what their master plan is and how it's been revised. Then they'll come back for the individual buildings that they're actually constructing or reconstructing.
Sure. And I'm just trying to get a sense of your workload. Do you have other departments that are in the process right now of expansion or rebuilding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beverly, probably our biggest client is the Facilities Division of DAS. Mostly because they are the property managers for so many agencies. And they've identified a number of projects that they are assisting with. In fact, they are really their client is the Justice Department on this justice planning and so forth. So we work very closely with the Facilities Division for most of the projects that come forward.
If I could just follow up, the general approval having been sought, and which would be tantamount to this early warning system in effect, if an agency could construct this facility using certificates of participation, they really wouldn't need to come to the legislature to proceed with any kind of construction, would they?
Mr. Chair, I think that's right. The one thing that maybe this is a luxury of the Capital Planning Commission, but commission members frankly don't care where the money comes from. And there is no review under our statutory authority of how much a building costs or whether it's cost effective to build it or not. I don't mean to sound,
I appreciate
it. Make it sound as if we, you know, that it's irrelevant. I mean, obviously, if someone were to bring an agency were to bring a building to the Capital Planning Commission that was clearly, you know, outlandish and outrageous, I would think that there would be some reluctance on the part of the commission, even though that statutory authority doesn't exist. The financing scheme, whatever it may be, of a particular project is not within the Capital Planning Commission's jurisdiction to review.
So basically, coming back to the line of questioning, Representative Messerly was working towards them. If within the pot of money to construct the facility, they found federal dollars and there were some rent monies that are presently being used by that particular agency and so forth, then really what could happen is without any additional notification to the legislature or any other elected officials, then really agencies could basically, under the direction of the Capital Planning Commission, could probably proceed to break ground and, assuming that everything else, all the rest of the permits and so forth, were filed through the liaison authority which it has, really they'd pretty much be able to proceed then at that point. assuming that you were satisfied with the financing and satisfactory.
I believe that's correct, although Chair, I guess one of the oversight functions of the Commission, whether it's formally identified this way in our statute or not, is that there are two members of the legislature on our commission.
Okay.
And I think that's a good thing, because it not only provides, again, as I say, the early warning system for those representatives who maybe, as projects come to our attention or are brought to us prior to a legislative session, so also projects that come to us after a legislative session, and I think the members who have been on our commission have been well informed as to what those projects were because they review them from a financial perspective. But also the situation that you've described, if there was actually there was no legislative oversight prior to that project going forward, there will be that kind of oversight when the project comes to the commission.
Can I ask the $64 question at that point, if I may, Mr. Capps, and that is, would you feel comfortable with a budget note which would perhaps direct the Capital Planning Commission that if in your in your scope of 2 years, particularly under the oscilloscope as it moves closer and closer, would you feel comfortable with the budget note which would direct the Capital Planning Commission to notify the legislature before you commence at the task force level of there is the spot and here are the parameters, would you feel comfortable in having such a footnote so that at no point I don't want to try and second guess your job, but neither do I want to see bulldozers necessarily pulling up at some point on the Capitol Mall and saying this is the spot we'd like to go ahead and, you know, all of a sudden stakes show up one day and the cats show up the next day, and would you feel comfortable with that kind of a...
Mr. Chair, would you mind if I defer? I don't mind answering that question, but our chair is also here, and I wonder if that's maybe a little bit more of a policy question for the commission.
Sure.
Oh, it's not here. I didn't turn around to see if it was. Well, see, I can't defer now again, so now I have to fight for it.
Let me recognize Senator Jones.
Virtually all of that construction that's done by the state goes through the legislative process. It'll go through the Ways and Means process, part of the capital construction budget, and the committee that will look at all of those things. And no building that's, or even major renovations that are proposed that are going to take authorization for money will escape getting approval here before they go forward.
Thank you, Senator Joe. I guess I was looking for the first blip in the oscilloscope where the actual commission would give it credence that yes, they would. In other words, and I had no idea that this had happened with regard to the particular building represented initially. Was discussing that, the first blip that shows up on the screen. That it be it at least some sort of a notification to the legislature, so that if there are ideas that perhaps some single agency would just dearly love to be, you know, exactly where another agency should be at some point, and that to use the example that you talked about the possibility of the siting of a judicial building of some kind, perhaps the justice building should be closer to another one of the nine adopted planning areas, perhaps closer to one of our penal institutions, for instance. I'm just using that as an example. It may not work there.
Pack it right on at the end of it and have a jury trial.
I guess my question is, would you feel uncomfortable if we ask for some
at the task force level, as I go through the formal siting, decision and order, following the task force, I'm wondering if at the task force level, between the task force level and the formal decision and siting order, if it would be appropriate to notify other than the two elected members that sit on the Capital Planning Commission, so that at no time could your department be criticized for taking action above and beyond the scope of what other folks feel comfortable with.
Mr. Chair, appropriate is perhaps a more of a decision that you could make, but if that is something that you would choose to do, it certainly is something that's feasible for us to do. If that's part of the keeping the legislature informed as to what agencies are doing with their capital funding from whatever source.
Correct me if I'm wrong. My belief is that you just sort of do review of proposals that come to you, and that those proposals surely must come from state government, and those would go through DAS. Maybe the best budget note would be on the DAS budget to say that when they're planning major expansion of facilities, that they come to some legislative agency. By the time it gets to you, it's well underway and the decisions are made, isn't it? You're just reviewing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, I think that's essentially true. If you think about the Capital Planning Commission as really mostly a land use entity that is looking at the appropriateness of a building location or a building modification in terms of its impact on the surrounding environment, there isn't a lot in that summary description that has to do with financing or even the staging of financing or the anticipation of a project with financing being one of the early steps that any agency would have to consider in order to determine what
initiating the building itself, initiating the concept of the building.
That's true, and I do believe
it's that.
I do believe, and I think it's, I wish I could remember the bill number, but there was legislation passed in the last legislative session that did create a review body that dealt with the financial feasibility and appropriateness of state agencies' capital construction statewide. So there is a review body. I think it reports to the director of Department of Administrative Services.
That bill doesn't go into the level of the siting decision, the formal siting decision, nor the order to go ahead and proceed to anything of that nature. It just goes ahead and authenticates that there is a need and to proceed. It doesn't identify which of the adopted area plans that the building would go in. I guess I'm just trying to anticipate, and I hesitate to use anything as an example, such as the siting of the prison, but I'm wondering if a dialogue perhaps earlier on, and I recognize that's a whole different issue, the dialogue earlier on may have pulled other folks out of that fray, or involved in the people that early on, but pretty tough to get a consensus on some of those things, but I just wondered if you would feel uncomfortable if we were perhaps for such a budget note basically felt by the Capital Planning Commission to be too over restrictive, too micromanagement oriented.
Mr. Chair, not at all, and I think we generally take pride in our ability to communicate openly with all agencies and with all affected parties. That's something we take very seriously.
I've sensed that, Mr. Katz, and I appreciate your candidness, and I thank you for that input. I guess I guess we could try it for a session again. It's not to tell them whether or not they can or not. It would just be to look at between the task force and the formal decision, and it's certainly the authorization and authority would already have come from the legislature. If there are no other questions, we'll move to a work session then with regard to the Capital Planning Commission, Senate Bill 5503. If no other questions, we'll move now to the work session, closing the public hearing on 5503, Capital Planning Commission. Georgine Bailey?
Yes, Mr. Chairman of the committee, part of that three-page package I gave you, the top page, is a memorandum that includes the recommendations from the legislative fiscal office. I don't think I need to go over the background anymore. We've had a good discussion of that. But the legislative fiscal office recommends approval of the governor's recommended budget of $248,200 other funds and two positions, 1.63 full-time equivalent. One thing that I would like to point out is that with the adjustments and the Department of Administrative Services has proposed reducing its charge to small agencies. This is one of those small agencies. And if this subcommittee and the Legislative Assembly approves the DAS administrative reductions as they have been proposed, that bill hasn't been heard yet, but as they have been proposed, this agency commission would realize a $13,001 reduction in its charges by DAS, and that's for accounting and budgeting and other services, if you remember. In addition, the Secretary of State has proposed a different process for assessing agencies for audit services, and that tentatively is a $2,718 reduction in this budget. The total of those two amounts are $15,719 expenditures that they will incur. That's less than the $248,000, but those reductions will be captured in another bill. That's why they're not recommended to be reduced from the
$248,000. Are there any questions?
Just what other bill will the reductions be captured in?
I don't know if you remember last biennium, DAS assessment was reduced, and there was a House Bill 5047, and it had all the agencies and the adjustments to their expenditure limitations that resulted from those reductions in assessment. And so it'll be a similar kind of bill. It'll be a blank bill that we will amend to capture those reductions.
Somewhat a cleanup, yeah. We've heard the recommendations by the Legislative Fiscal Office. Linda Ames, is that right? Linda, did you have any comments on behalf of the Department of Administrative Services? Thank you. Would there be any objection to the language that we talked about briefly relative to the early warning system somewhere between the task force and the actual fighting so that an early warning system could go into effect so as to alleviate any criticism of the Capital Planning Commission of doing something that unbeknownst to the members.
I wouldn't object at all, but I don't think there's any need. I don't think they do anything unbeknownst to people, but if you think so, usually by the time those measures get to them, they're pretty widely known and sure been reported already. But I have no objection if they don't.
I wish that we could say that all departments would always be managed as well as Mr. Capps is doing here, and we need not always be that fortunate. So,
I don't think it's necessary, but I just wouldn't object to it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would simply add that I believe it was the Senate bill that was passed in the biennium that Mr. Capps referred to earlier does require agencies to bring in their capital construction plans in a six-year window. So with the capital construction, you see today what they're planning 6 years out. I don't know if that would address the problem that you're discussing.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bailey. I guess my concern was that the issue of the nine adopted area plans, that's normally a decision, it sounds like, from the conversation today,
that that's normally a decision somewhere between the Capital Planning Commission task force and the adoption of a formal siting and a decision and an order. And that's, I think what happens is that that's where the siting issue may become an issue. So if that's satisfactory, then I would like to go ahead and add that as a budget note, and perhaps at some point someone in another session could ask that to be codified, because the system seems to work very well now, and the 6-year window is wonderful. It's just the issue of siting, and someone may not appreciate the sanctity of the mall as much as some of the folks have for many, many years.
Chair, could we ask staff to bring it back to look at it?
You bet. Yes, sir. Is there any objection to passing the budget then as recommended, and then they'll have an opportunity to go ahead and approve that language unless you get sufficient language there that you're comfortable with?
Mr. Chairman, for the committee, I would rather have a conversation with the chair and make sure I understand precisely what he can.
If there are no objections to the recommendation of department
chair, and once we get it, I wonder if they could be here to respond to it, so we can see whether we're asking them to do something that they reasonably can do, and it won't be terribly burdensome because we don't want to.
Certainly, what we could do is send it out to them and then have them respond, and then perhaps take action to add it on as a budget note, so that we wouldn't have a necessity of a formal hearing with them having to come back and take time away from their schedule. The recommendation then of Legislative Fiscal Office is that we approve at this time the budget under the Capital Planning Commission Senate Bill 5503 of other funds in the total amount of $248,200. If there are no objections, then we'll go ahead and order that with the due pass recommendation to the full Ways and Means. Senator Crowe, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
And we'll hold on moving that. We won't move that through this next Friday. We'll go ahead and get the other language of the trip. And Senator Crowe, would you like to carry that to the floor of the Senate as well? And would you like to take that to the floor of the House?
Sure.
Thank you very much. We'll meet then back again on that language relative to the budget motion at a later time, and we'll schedule that and welcome to it. But I'd like for you folks to go ahead and have an opportunity to review that, and then if you'll respond to Ms. Bailey in writing, then we can sniff that appropriately, and there's no hurry. Tomorrow will be fine. Thank you. Thank you very kindly. We appreciate your participation here today, and we do appreciate it. Thanks again. We'll go ahead and close then 5503, pending the language for the actual budget note to be prepared and agreed upon through Legislative Fiscal Office and the Capital Planning Commission. Okay. We have, you've gone all the way through 5055, 5056, House Bill 5056.
I mean, we had public testimony yesterday.
Had public testimony. Did we carry that over?
Yes, we did.
We did carry that over. We have some folks here from the Board of Public Broadcasting. So, let's go ahead then and open the public hearing portion of House Bill 5056. And I'm at a distinct disadvantage because I was only here for just probably 15 or 20 minutes, or well, the last half hour, I guess, of the public hearing portion of the meeting yesterday. Ms. Duncan, would you like to come forward, please? Relative to House Bill 5056, the amount that is to be inserted as a general fund item is $3,350,509 is the request. Now, if you'll indulge the chair for just a moment, yesterday, following the hearing, I asked some questions about the full, I think we heard of a $15 million total budget, and I have checked with the legislative fiscal officer, Mr. Stinson, and he did not feel it would be inappropriate that we ask for a full budget. Would that be possible to ask of the Oregon Public Broadcasting that a full budget be sent, both of resources and disbursements, to Georgine Bailey, as you are the analyst on that issue?
Mr. Chairman, and for the record, Kim Duncan, Vice President of Oregon Public Broadcasting. We can provide you a full budget. I have a summary budget here that you might want to take a look at, revenue and expenses. I don't know if you want to go into all the detail in our budget. I'm wondering how expensive you want us to get.
Do you have sufficient copies for each of the members? Okay.
Mr. Chair, you may not want to do that given the fact that you're a CPA.
I'm sorry. I thought you indicated that Ms. Bailey was, or that Ms. Duncan was a CPA, and I don't know. I have a conflict of interest. let me think quickly.
One of the great blessings of working with Chair Butler is he's very detail oriented.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott Butler, who is that?
Would you like to just go through that, please, if you would be so kind as Duncan?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What you are looking at is our annual operating budget for this current fiscal year. We do not have our next fiscal year budget done. In part, it's waiting for a decision out of this body. But we do anticipate that our 99-2000 budget is going to be pretty close to the same amount. We will probably hit $16 million, but not probably go too far over that. In revenue, membership line, this is what everybody complains about Oregon Public Broadcasting. When we're on raising money on the air, radio, and television, but this is the product of it. Once you make your initial contribution, we solicit you then through direct mail. We have between 110,000 and 120,000 members statewide. This makes us the largest private membership organization in the state. If you look at the next line, major gifts, $575,000. These are gifts given to us by donors of $1,000 or more. So the line above, I think, becomes even more significant. We are funded by small gifts by many, many people all over the state. Underwriting in a different business might be called advertising, but it's what you see on our air when people say, this program was made possible by a gift from. We raise this underwriting from local businesses in this market only. A number of programs that we acquire from national sources carry national underwriting with it as well. So when you see an underwriting credit to a national company, Archer Daniel Midlands, for example, and then you see a Fred Meyer underwriting. Fred Meyer underwriting has been solicited by our salespeople here within this market, and the other pieces come from a national solicitation. So it's $1.6 million from Oregon businesses.
Senator Crowe's recommendation. Mm-hmm.
Do you have limitations on that activity? Are you out to get all the underwriters you can, or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, we would not turn down any money. However, there are limitations on what we can say on our air, and that actually restricts the amount of money that we're able to earn, because when public broadcasting first started soliciting underwriting, most of those contributions came out of their philanthropic arm of their company. Today, we are receiving that money usually out of the advertising marketing department. There's a desire on behalf of businesses that to get pretty aggressive about their messages, but we are prohibited by federal law from putting a call to action on our air. So we cannot say, come to store X and buy the pink piggy bank for $5.99 today. We can't do that, or we would lose our license. What we can do is give a short descriptor of what the business is about, and you will hear that. And currently within our industry nationally, there's a huge debate going on about how far we can stretch that limit and increase the underwriting without decreasing the membership support, because donors sometimes find that offensive. So we walk this really fine line.
So we could have, let's say, this next program, educational program, is brought to you by Senator Cho, who's always been a champion of higher education.
I don't want to play salary.
If we could afford it.
I do have a question in that regard, and relative to this group of funds that are being basically acquired from the public, do you have an active program to encourage unit trusts and other insurance folks that work with you on an illusionary basis to gratuitously provide you some kind of an opportunity to, if you will, receive bequests and other donations of that nature?
Mr. Chairman, this is an area that is growing for us. We call it planned giving. We have had one staff person for about 6 years in this area, and he was able to build up building an endowment, about $1 million into an endowment. Year 7 and 8 of this operation, we increased it. I believe we're up to close to $5 million. It's one of these things we have to do a lot of time seeding it, and then it starts to move. We're adding another staff member, and we are working regularly with CPAs, insurance planners, are holding a number of seminars around the state. We're spreading it around the state so that people understand we are a giving option.
Great. That certainly, the planned giving and estate planning is probably one of the resources that is most overlooked. We look for the $10 and $20 gifts or $100 gifts, and sometimes walk past the $1 million gifts of people who would like to be able to give and yet don't want to be either known during their life or hounded on a regular basis for the smaller gifts.
Chairman, we believe that this really is going to be a significant area of growth for us, and a way that a lot of people can support us that they otherwise wouldn't have realized they could have. Just recently, we were given a restaurant, one of our more unusual gifts, a restaurant in Milwaukee that was very well known to people for years, called The Castle. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. But it had closed and had been on the market, and the owners turned it over to us, and we in turn resold it, and I believe it was over $500,000 to OPB. The new owners, when they reopen that restaurant, are having the first night will be an OPB benefit. Things like that are so heartwarming and wonderful, and we'll be able to open the doors there to the community.
Representative Crawford is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of your revenue income comes from other entrepreneurial activities within OPB other than your production facilities? Sometimes when I'm watching the telethon or whatever, I'll see OPB mugs or hats and those kinds of things. Do you do some of that activity also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cook, when you see premiums, we call those premiums for membership, that is part of our cost of raising dollars for membership. We don't make money off of those pieces per se. We make, on the line says other, $3,065,000. Major portion of the revenues there come from our production business. We make our money not on the productions per se. We make the money what we call the aftermarket, sales of videos, holding the rights, repackaging the materials. There is some money in that other column, however, that comes from a group of miscellaneous activities. we rent our studio, for example, to filmmakers that are in town. They need a good facility. Ours is dark. We use it. We will rent that to them. We do some teleconferencing because we have, obviously, access to satellite. We uplink, we downlink. We will bring in groups. They will have a teleconference. They'll pay us for the use of that facility. We, on occasion, do some production for hire if we're able to spare staff and we've got a gap in our production schedule and somebody needs a quick video done, we'll run out and do that. We try to be very savvy and aware of opportunities so that we can develop other revenue. But the bulk of it is always going to be from what we do know how to do, and that's produce.
Certainly by adding an additional person, you're planned giving and seeking planned gifts and unit trusts and those kinds of things that could provide the numbers on a unit trust when you've got somebody who's sitting on a substantial asset is absolutely phenomenal when they stop and think about it, and if they have no other heirs or in conjunction, you say, with underwriters or insurance agencies, that can be a great benefit. So I commend you for recognizing that. Please proceed.
Okay. We'll go down to the next line. CPB, and I think I need to put some money into the... Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is...
Chairman, I think I heard a quarter hit the table.
I am. Corporation for Public Broadcasting, you've seen it probably on our air, if you watch our air. This is what we call our federal dollars. This is the agency through which we receive our federal dollars. They are given to us on a highly complex formula basis that's based on how much money we raise outside of the federal government. The more money we raise from private funds, the fewer dollars we receive from the federal government. State funds, I believe you understand what that is, interest earnings, and then other, which we just discussed, and for the total of $15.8 million. I can go through the expense side if you'd like me to.
Please, Mr. Chairman,
the expense side, we've rolled these up. This is basically what you're seeing here is an organizational structure for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Our administration costs, administration in our operation includes accounting, includes personnel, includes our board and all the board support-related activities. Engineering. The engineering costs are indeed what we request the state to cover. Engineering costs include our personnel costs. We have engineers at our network headquarters. We have an engineer in Corvallis, another in Bend, somebody else in LeGrand and Eugene, to service this large network of facilities, translators, and transmitters. In your briefing book, you have this map that shows you how extensive our capital equipment is spread all over the state, and that's what we support through engineering. TV programming. These are the costs to acquire programs. Yesterday, Mr. Orem talked about how expensive it is to produce versus acquire. We buy programs from PBS. We buy programs from a myriad other programming sources as well in order to fill out our schedule. And that is the bulk of the cost there. But it also includes something we call master control. Every broadcast operation has a master control operation. This is what it takes to bring a picture from our facility to your home. And that is a 24-hour-a-day operation. Radio, our radio costs are 1.7. These costs include radio operations, radio engineering, and then the cost for our daily news, statewide news. Oregon Considered, you hear it at 4:30 every day on OPB, and you hear outtakes from it through scattered throughout the news all day. And that supports the reporting staff in radio as well. It also covers the cost for a lesser-known service of ours called Golden Hours. Golden Hours is a radio reading service, and you get it on your secondary audio channel, on a sat channel. And we read newspapers every day. We read magazine articles. We read bus schedules for people who are print impaired or the home, you know, the homebound. We also have a lot of programming dealing with disabilities. It is staffed 24 hours a day by two disabled people and a score of volunteers. You come into our facility at 2 a.m. in the morning, you will see a volunteer basically programming that operation. It's quite impressive.
2 a.m. In fact, almost the very people in the
It's a stunning piece, and it's something we wish we could put more money into, frankly, because we think we could improve the use levels. Yeah. TV production. This includes our production for local markets and our production for international and international markets. TV production is very expensive. We pride ourselves on being lean and mean and very careful with where we spend funds. We work our facility double shifted so that we do not have highly valuable capital equipment sitting idle if we don't need to have it there. We will also rent our edit. We have edit suites where you come in and we'll put a video together. We will rent edit suites if we can do that, if we do see them not scheduled for a period of time. And we will rent them to people and they'll get a shift. Come in and edit your video from midnight till 7 and people are happy to do it. We have good equipment. Development, these are our costs, obviously, to raise our funds. Our development department, you might be interested to know, in the last 6 years has twice won the best development department in the nation among 250 public broadcasters. We're very, very proud of it. They are an enormously efficient and innovative group of people. They raise money from members. They raise money from underwriting. They raise money from major gifts, planned giving, and are also the ones responsible for the on-air television pledge that you see and adore. Marketing. Marketing costs are largely our print materials, the monthly magazine that if you were a member you would be receiving, and I did give a copy to you all in a packet. We have a couple of other publications, one that goes to teachers every month, another that goes to daycare providers every month. We also obviously purchase print advertising so that we can guarantee people are aware of what our programming is, and we try to buy that in the most efficient way possible. We should be doing a lot more in that area. We also provide obviously a lot of support to what we call our internal products, so that all the products that we have are provided the kind of print promotion materials that they need. Marketing department also does our strategic planning. If you move down, you will see that we have 165 employees. We do throughout the year pull in a few other employees. This year, 8 additional employees who are there on a project contract basis. When someone has basically provided grant money to do project X, and we'll pull in an employee, and they're in and out based on that, the conditions of that particular project. Further below, what you can see is just the breakout by salaries and benefits at $8.3 million. Our program dues and acquisitions. These are costs that we cannot avoid. This is what it costs us to buy programs, our dues to PBS, our dues to NPR, and the cost of buying programs from other program sources. Then at the $1.132 million number, is basically the engineering maintenance cost for our capital plant, and then we have member services and solicitations, and then our other services and supplies.
There's two questions, if I may, Mrs. Duncan. In your development expenses, the cost of raising money and so forth, is that where the plan giving is charged to?
Okay.
And the second is that you talked about the leasing out of the facilities to third parties, and you must have some rather substantial equipment here. The broadcast service and supply, does that include the replacement of the equipment? Tell me about your facility. Is it paid for? Do we anticipate major renovation, remodeling, roof, those kinds of things? What can give us some, there's no depreciation on it, at least scheduled.
Mr. Chairman, we try to make all of our major capital purchases, make a full purchase of them.
Excuse me.
Chairman, can I continue?
Please.
We purchased our building 10 years ago. That was done through bonds. The bonds were paid off. There was a state contribution into that $15 million project. We purchased our major capital equipment. We try to do it off of major grants. We obviously have annual capital operating capital expenses and depreciation, and we do take that. We try to purchase our equipment with an idea that we are looking long-term. We try to understand what the useful life of the equipment will be. I just returned from a meeting of the National Association of Broadcasters where all the latest equipment for broadcast production is on display. We are always trying to track, and then we try to work closely with producers within this market area, Tektronix, Sharp, Intel, and often they will assist us, give us advice on what we should be evaluating and how we should be evaluating it. As we move into the digital era, they've been remarkably helpful. They will bring in some of their equipment and say, ask us to test it for them. That will provide some feedback to them. In return, we have use of the equipment. So we really do try to be pretty practical and look at ways in which we operate as a community service and that these businesses, you know, may get something back from us. So that's what we're
technology environment probably certainly lends itself to the utilization of that expertise. We do have some other meetings that are going to start conflicting here very shortly. Are there any other questions?
Another question.
Yes, Representative Leonard is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious about an issue having to do really with specifically radio programming. And in some discussions I've had recently, there have been some questions regarding the World Affairs Council based in Portland and some of the excellent guests that they bring and speakers there from all over the world, which I'm sure you're well aware of. And the concern is that up to, I guess, about 20 years ago, some of those were actually being broadcast on OPB. And they're really a kind of a unique form. And they're, of course, they're Oregon-based. That forum is Oregon-based. And the concern is, how can we go about getting some coverage of those kinds of forums when they occur?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, you're speaking to a former World Affairs Council board member.
Oh,
okay. OPB has supported World Affairs Council in recent years on it for a couple of big speakers that they brought in. But basically what we do with the World Affairs Council or any other group that's bringing in some noteworthy speakers, if they're interested in trying to get this on our air, our 1 o'clock Monday through Friday time slot is reserved for good, meaty lecture series. We try to make them all local. All groups like this have to have high-quality recording, and not every group can afford to do that. We cannot afford to go out and provide all that equipment and recording ourselves for them. But we tell them exactly what they need to do. Then we take a listen to the lectures, and you know, you don't often know how good a lecture is until after it's been given. Not everything that you think is going to be terrific radio ends up being terrific radio, so we try to listen and make sure that we can get something on the air that will hold the audience's interest. And then we air it. All the World Affairs Council needs to do is give us a call, and they can call me directly, and we will take a look at what's out there. We really like to have local subject programs on the air.
Thanks, Senator Ryan. Are there any other questions, Senator Lim?
Basically, I'd like to make some comments. I think this OPD is well organized, and more than 50% coming from the membership, and also very one of the smallest amount of state government gives. at the end of the state. But at the same time, I hope when I ask a question yesterday to the, is it the chairman or the gentleman?
The chairman, Senator Lynn, that was our president and CEO.
Yes, president and CEO. I asked a question concerning the any program for the minorities, which we have about 12% of our state population, largest population that he answered. We just put some program, something you know, out of the country, the cultural issue. He didn't answer exactly what I had in mind. I hope you will pay close attention, sensitive on the minority issue, at least let him be a part of this great program. And then, you know, that's what I'm asking for. I know you have the funding problem, trying to make localize it is more costly. I understand that, but at least I hope that you take some attention on those minority issues. Maybe it might be helpful to our state. That's my comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Lynn. Are there other comments or questions for Ms. Duncan? We have sufficient to go to work session at this particular point. Are there any other concerns to be expressed or discussed relative to the budget before we go into work session? Allowing you an opportunity to look at it, we will then move to a work session on House Bill 5056.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 5056 to the Forward and Means Committee with a DPAS recommendation.
Okay,
as proposed by
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, attached to the memorandum from Legislative Fiscal Office is a copy of proposed amendments to House Bill 5056 that amends House Bill 5056 to include the amount that's included in the governor's recommended budget, $3,350,509.
I'll move the dash one amendments to House Bill 5056.
We heard the proposal by the that we accept House Bill 5056 with the dash one amendments. Are there any objections?
Question on the dash one amendment.
Representative,
is this a different policy than currently the allocation by quarters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, no, it isn't. It allows the dash to pay the money quarterly.
And that's what they currently do.
Yes, that's correct.
We were given options early on to try and seek efficiencies of up to 4% in all of the general fund budgets that we were looking for, and if I even tried to find the 4% efficiency in a budget which is increasing by barely the consumer price index, I'd really have to dig, and besides that, I think Ms. Duncan would probably ask me to change my will and make it into plan giving in order to even consider that.
So I need to go over to the
Okay. Are there any objections to the motion that we accept House Bill 5056 with a dash one amendment?
I think we have to vote on the amendment and then on the bill. So we vote on the amendment. I should vote on the dash one amendment.
Okay.
And we vote on House Bill 5056 as amended.
All right. Are there any dissenters to the dash one amendment, the 5056? So being done, we'll order that incorporated into 5056. Representing Leonard, further moves that we then accept House Bill 5056 as amended with the dash one amendment. Are there any objections? So being done, we'll order that to go then to with a due pass recommendation to the full Ways and Means. Representative Leonard, would you like to hear that? And let's see. Senator Lynn,
would you
carry that? Thank you very much to the Senate. Let's see. Representative Hanson, would you carry that? Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming today. Okay. We've got to. Representative Hanson. We have before us today a public work session on House Bill 5025, ready to go with that. Let's open up the public work session on House Bill 5025, Office of the Governor. Public hearing.
Bill, did you bring up the quarters?
No, I'm wearing them. I'm very careful.
We're covered, not to worry.
Do you get reimbursed for that?
You want to ask me to stand for
okay, Mr. Wyatt, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bill Wyatt. I'm Chief of Staff to Governor Sanchez Summer. And do you want me to proceed, or how do you want to?
Why don't we go ahead and let Legislative Fiscal give us a brief overview, and then we'll proceed for that. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did send out a memo yesterday with an overview of this budget, the governor's budget. I will pass it out again. But the governor's budget before you is essentially a current service level budget with two exceptions that are requests for addition, reclassification of positions. There are four positions, I believe, that they asked for reclassification. And total cost of a little over $40,000, general fund portion of that is about $25,000, I think, $27,000. The request also contains some upgrades for telephone equipment, telephone communications within the governor's office. The other adjustment to the current level of services to transfer two positions from the governor's office back to the information resource management division of the Department of Administrative Services. That's pretty much an offset and be reflected as an increase in the Department of Administrative Services budget. Those were other funds. So before you is our analysis. I have a memo from myself to you, our analysis that's the governor's budget request, as well as the last sheet is the one we'll be working off of, which can walk the committee through from the legislatively approved budget to the current service level in the EHF and the changes that have been requested. With that, sir,
Are there any questions of legislative fiscal?
We'll proceed, Mr. White.
Thank you very much. You got Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I thought I might just briefly run through the basic functions of the governor's office, because despite the fact that all of us live and work in this building, it's not often that you have a chance to step back and reflect on that for a moment. I thought it might be useful to do that. I think one way to think about the office of the governor is to imagine Oregon state government as a private corporation, a large private corporation. And the way to imagine our office is to serve as the office of the president, which many large companies have, or the office of the chairman and chief executive officer. And I think that's really the way we've tried to organize ourselves, and frankly, I think that's the way that state government has been organized over the course of the last several biennia. We've been moving increasingly in that direction with the Department of Administrative Services, Mr. Yunker, serving as kind of the chief operating officer of state government, I think. And my own personal view, having been here now for 4.5 years, a former member from many, many years ago, this is a wise direction to pursue. I think that having the governor have a broad policy look without having to manage the day-to-day details, and yet having Dash here has served us all very well. And so our office has essentially, I would say, a policy orientation, and it has been as well several very specific legal functions and roles. We have several individuals in the office who provide policy analysis and advice to the governor and each of you in their various roles that run into these folks in various ways. That is, I think, the most significant function in the office. In addition, we have a policy administrative liaison with legislators, state agencies, local governments, and others. And we have, as you can imagine, a tremendous amount of contact with citizens, private companies, local governments, certainly legislators, particularly during the session, legislative committees, and other institutions. Executive appointments. The governor in a four-year term will make about 2,000 executive appointments, many of which require, I think about half of which require Senate confirmation. There is the usual amount of background work that goes along with that. Extraditions. The governor has the responsibility for seeking extraditions. The administrative function is currently housed in the state police, but we end up having to run an awful lot of the paper through our office, and it's more than you can imagine. Federal agency and federal coordination. The governor is often on point as a central point of contact with federal agencies, with the White House, occasionally and certainly with members of the Oregon delegation. Appeals for pardon and clemency. The governor of Oregon has extraordinary powers with respect to pardon and clemency, which I might add is used so sparingly that I think not a single one has yet been granted, but they require an exceptional amount of review, which we give them. Emergency management liaison. I think that not something we thought about or that I thought about before signing up for this, but we've had our shares of disasters, everything but locusts, and I'm sure that in the next 3 years or so, we'll probably see some of those.
Don't say that.
I don't
know.
Thank
you,
Bob.
I may need it if the locusts come. You understand that. That's about how, what I'll have left.
Judicial appointments. As you know, as is often the case, district, now circuit court judges, appellate court judges, will occasionally leave prior to completing their term, creating a vacancy. The governor has responsibility to appoint and fill those vacancies, and that is an exceptional undertaking as well. Citizen problem solving. I think the official title in our budget is called Citizens Representative, but it's or Ombudsperson. I like to characterize it as citizen problem solving. Right through this door over here, folks walk in, knock on the door, and they've got a problem. A check hasn't arrived. A permit hasn't been granted. Very often, these are people who have exhausted all of their remedies in state agencies, and they've come to us to help. And we have several people there who basically case manage these kinds of issues. Public information and speech writing. The governor gives hundreds of speeches during the course of the year, and these are the folks who support him. In addition, provide public information on the range of subjects which we are asked to comment on. And then the final two items are included in the governor's office budget, and this was done some time ago. One is affirmative action. We have two individuals who are included in the budget, paid for, as you, I think, can see in the budget documents here, through an assessment applied by the HR function in DAS. And they do a couple of things. First of all, they have, since we've been there, created a really outstanding database that is used by all agencies, which profiles their workforce. Who are they hiring? We track by race, age, gender, ethnicity, probably a couple that I'm forgetting about. And it's very important and useful information. It's been more difficult than you can imagine to build the system by which we now can track that. We don't enforce quotas, obviously. That's not a remedy available in law for the most part anymore, but we do communicate regularly with agencies so they know you know, how they're doing against the available workforce, and I think that's the big improvement we've been able to make here. This is a function that was housed historically in the governor's office, I think she came in the late 70s, and the idea was to put it in our office to give it the kind of profile that would cause the agency directors to pay attention, and my intent is they do that. And then finally, the Office of Minority, I say comma, women and emerging small business, because often people think it's minority women in emerging small business, and it's three items there. And this function is really designed to do a couple of things. First, to the greatest extent possible, engage in outreach with the minority women and emerging small business community to make them aware of the business opportunities that exist with state government. Small contractors, for example. We, again, there are no quotas that are managed in this area, and there have been several recent Supreme Court decisions that we've adapted to, essentially. But they're creating a database that is available for these businesses. The second piece of that is outreach, knocking on doors and making sure that people are aware of these opportunities. The state of Oregon has thousands, I would guess, of small contracts which are available on a bid basis. Sometimes on a small contracts in particular are just let because it would cost too much to take a $500 item out. And we're this function is essentially attempting to outreach to the affected communities here. And again, I think the function, or the reason why this function is in the governor's office, this was done years ago, was to give it the kind of profile that would cause agencies and agency directors to pay attention. And I hate to emphasize that too much because in a couple of past sessions, this resulted in people attaching functions to our office on the theory that it will cause them to pay attention, which only means that we end up with wasting attorneys in our office. The last thing I would say in general about the government's office is that we have tried to avoid having functions in our office which are what I would characterize as day-to-day management functions. We have tried very hard to focus on policy and not the day-to-day administration, favoring instead the model that we've been working for over the last decade, which is to have the Department of Administrative Services in almost every case be the principal source for that activity. Now, in terms of the budget detail, there is an organization chart which basically reflects, I think, what I've just talked to you about in general about our budget. And the only really significant thing I can say about the change in our budget as it currently is and where it's headed is that we're reducing two positions. And those two positions were the result of something that I just referenced, which was an effort by the, I think, by the 95 session to create within the Office of the Governor a telecommunications policy advisor that came with two positions. The individual who was originally hired for that left about 9 or 10 months ago, and we have temporarily assigned that role to the state's Chief Information Officer, Ms. Dung Masiati, with whom I believe you're familiar. And have chosen to eliminate these two positions from our office, and I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen with the positions by the time you all are done this session. They will either be in DAS IRMD or the function itself will go away, but in any event, they will be, we propose that they be removed from the governor's office budget. I think there was, and you can see, I don't know, it's just a chart, I don't know if they've got a copy of the chart, but the FTE has seen relatively, in fact, I think we're back to where we started from. We have as many FTE in the budget today as Governor Attia did back in the mid-80s. And the budget growth itself has been moderate. The only packages that we have relate to the, of course, the mandatory packages, but then the reclassifications that were referenced earlier. And these are just people who, through the course, over the course of the last 4 years, have assumed new or different responsibilities within the office. We've had them reviewed by the HR folks within DAS to ascertain whether the reclasses are appropriate, and we'd like to finance them. The telecommunications package is a Y2K issue. We have an old phone system. It's a, like a 1989 phone system, and this is the last little checkoff on our office's Y2K readiness. And we had originally thought about trying to acquire a new phone system this time, but we'll make it through. I hope we'll make it through one more biennium.
That's not package in the phone.
Yes, that is. No, that's not a new phone system. That's just an upgrade.
That's just an upgrade.
Yeah, and it's a Y2K upgrade. That's 105, right? No, what is it? Package number 104.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that includes telephone policy and assistance.
Oh, sorry. 105 is the telecommunication policy, which we're moving over to DAS.
Oh, okay.
Right, out of our budget. So two positions and the resources that came with it would be officially moved back to DAS IRMD.
Are there any questions to that particular point as we look through the chart, the organization chart? If past the 3 o'clock hour, we apologize, Mr. Hyatt, for being started late. Are there any questions of members at this time? If we can pick up tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we thank you, Mr. Wyatt, for coming down. I apologize for being started late. The lines we've had here are recommending government office to our general government committee. If there's no further business this time, then it's going to be 1 o'clock in the morning. Thank you very much.